in reference to the West Indian population having a high rate of crime or having a tendency toward dirtiness, he explained. Malcolm critiqued racial progress as eliciting only token reforms, while structural racism, injustice, and violence remained. He portrayed King as a leader who kept black anger in check, but not for long, since the masses of black people in America are still living in the ghettos and the slums. They still are the victims of inferior housing. They are still the victims of a segregated school system, which gives them inferior education. Civil rights bills and movements for radical democracy were only as powerful as their implementation. He found it incredulous that, in the aftermath of the murders of three civil rights workers in Mississippi and the political assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Medgar Evers, and the four girls blown up in Birmingham, Alabama, anyone could possibly be talking about the Great Society coming into existence. Rather, he predicted that 1965 will be the longest and hottest and bloodiest year in American history. But he ended on a note of optimism, telling all who identified as political underdogs to no longer think of themselves as racial or ethnic minorities, but as part of global majority crying out for action and a struggle for citizenship, dignity, and justice. On February 13th, fresh from his latest European speaking tour, Malcolm learned that he would be evicted from his home in East Elmhurst, Queens. The news came after almost a year of legal wrangling between Malcolm and the Messenger over ownership of a house that Malcolm claimed as his own and that the NOI regarded as organizational property. He had to make plans to relocate his four daughters amid fresh news that Betty was pregnant with twins. Despite the eviction order and the stress of moving a growing family, Malcolm made plans to fly to Detroit the next day for a speaking engagement. He spent the day catching up on work at the Hotel Teresa before returning home to spend time with his family, then staying up late reading in his upstairs study. Just before 3 a.m., he awoke to the sounds of incendiary devices breaking through the windows of his home and filling it with smoke. At least three Molotov cocktails were launched at the house, but Malcolm managed to evacuate the entire family, who watched outside as their home burned down. In the face of Betty's strong protestation and the bewilderment of his four children, Malcolm kept his speaking engagement later that evening. His appearance in Detroit proved tragically memorable, since it marked a low point in the way his allies in Motor City would remember him. The dashing, well-dressed warrior for racial justice had disappeared. In a smoke-stained suit without a tie, Malcolm delivered his now standard stump speech on the black freedom struggle. His appearance was overshadowed by the various threats emanating from the combined enmity of the NOI and law enforcement officials. The New York Times published a front-page photograph of a somber-looking Malcolm stepping out of his blue Oldsmobile wearing an overcoat, trademark black horn-rimmed glasses, and a hat. This image of a weary Malcolm captured the lack of sleep, anxiety, and depression that had stalked him for much of the time since his departure from the nation. From Detroit, Malcolm returned to New York City on February 15th, where he took a room at the Statler Hilton Hotel. He kept a frenetic pace over the next 5 days, meeting with aides to discuss future organizational plans, speaking at Barnard College to over 1,000 students about the scourge of oppression and colonialism that black revolutionaries were fighting, and scouting out possible sites for a new home with Betty on Long Island. Sunday, February 21st, Malcolm woke up at the Hilton at 8 a.m., prepared to face a cold winter's day that would be highlighted by a rally at the Audubon Ballroom in West Harlem. He felt optimistic enough about the afternoon rally to call Betty and invite her to bring the children to the event. He left the hotel at 1 p.m. and drove his Oldsmobile to 146th Street and Broadway, judging this to be a safe enough distance to walk the 20 blocks north to the ballroom. Malcolm arrived on the second floor to the site of aides passing out copies of the OAAU newspaper, Blacklash. He proceeded to meet with OAAU staff behind the stage in a small room, confessing to the stunned group of advisors that he felt close to a nervous breakdown. The day's shifting itinerary troubled Malcolm. Several guest speakers had canceled, and plans to formally release the OAAU's official political program were rescheduled, the latest setback tied to the firebombing of his home a week earlier. He refused to allow his staff to search attendees for weapons, despite knowing full well that NOI assassins were plotting to kill him. He vowed to continue in the face of all obstacles. "No matter what has happened to me, I can't go out there complaining about it," he reasoned. "What I say has to be said with their problems in mind." Malcolm X walked onto the stage just before 3 p.m. to rapturous applause from a crowd of 400. He gave the crowd the Muslim greeting, "Assalamu alaikum," to which they responded, "Wa alaikum salam." And then a fight broke out several rows from the stage. "Hold it, hold it!" Malcolm shouted, straining to regain order as the bodyguards posted near him moved closer to the melee. A smoke bomb went off at the rear of the ballroom, creating pandemonium and leaving Malcolm unprotected on the rostrum. Three assassins converged on him in an instant, one firing a sawed-off shotgun into Malcolm's left side, piercing his heart, and the two others emptying handguns into his dying corpse. Betty covered her children amid the chaos. "They are killing my husband!" she screamed at one point, shielding her daughters with her body. By the time Betty felt safe enough to venture toward the stage, Malcolm was lying flat on his back, surrounded by several people trying to give him aid and comfort. As he lay on the floor, his shirt open revealing 7 bullet wounds, one OAAU member took snapshots that would become the major images of his death. A combination of Malcolm's aides, police officers, and OAAU members managed to place him on a stretcher and take him to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, where he arrived at 3:15 p.m. Doctors tried frantically to revive Malcolm before pronouncing his official death at 3:30. "The gentleman you knew as Malcolm X," announced the Columbia Presbyterian physician, "is dead." Malcolm's assassination turned a cold winter's afternoon in New York City into the site of an unfolding political tragedy. One shooter would be arrested, but witnesses identified perhaps as many as 4 others, and rumors, conspiracy theories, and debates over who killed Malcolm X persist until this day. The chaos surrounding Malcolm's death seemed to echo aspects of Malcolm's predictions of race war, but with the ironic twist that the struggle would be fought among blacks rather than across the color line. Malcolm's lawyer, Percy Sutton, told reporters that his fallen client planned to release the names of those who were trying to kill him at the Audubon. More than 10,000 people attended Malcolm's funeral, and more than 22,000 people viewed his body in Harlem, braving frigid temperatures to pay respects to a political leader whose significance grew even larger in death than it had been in life. Eulogized by his friend, the actor Ossie Davis, as our living black manhood at a Christian church in Harlem, Malcolm was accorded the funeral rites of his Orthodox Muslim beliefs. His corpse, draped in white robes, could be glimpsed through a glass-covered coffin, surrounded by 10 uniformed black police officers. The funeral service featured messages and tributes from Kwame Nkrumah, South Africa's African National Congress, and the ambassador of Jordan. The battle over Malcolm's legacy began immediately after his death. The autobiography of Malcolm X became an instant classic following its October publication. The book presented him to a global audience as the most important self-made black activist of the 20th century. Writer Alex Haley humanized Malcolm through a dramatic recounting of his improbable rise from street hustler and prison inmate to black nationalist, radical freedom fighter, and human rights crusader. Haley and Malcolm had begun working on the autobiography in 1963, and they developed an uncanny intellectual rapport, with the more mainstream black writer drawing out the sense of carefully hidden playfulness that characterized some of Malcolm's best speeches. The book's emphasis on the Nation of Islam as a redemptive force in black politics shifted after Malcolm's tumultuous departure, and the transformed narrative found Malcolm undergoing, like Homer's Odysseus, a series of trials on a rough journey to renaissance that would remain incomplete. Haley framed Malcolm's story as an uplift saga that smoothed over the rough edges and filtered the more complicated sides of Malcolm's politics, creating a tale of a man cut short just as his political perspective grew wide enough to include whites in the global political revolution he spent much of his life committed to. The New York Amsterdam News countered the fast-developing hagiography around Malcolm, publishing retrospective articles and essays that claimed to rescue the man from a developing mythology that cleaved him in two. The Bad Malcolm preached racial hatred, called whites devils, and looked to foment racial violence and wreck the civil rights movement. The Good Malcolm, after experiencing an epiphany during the Hajj, embraced the multiracial nature of Islam, rejected his past promotion of racial separatism, and sought to join civil rights struggles. Such neat juxtapositions made for good storytelling but poor history. They veered toward making him a cliché, rather than lauding him as an exemplar of the complicated rivers of oppression and resistance that animated the Black freedom struggle. Malcolm's deft ability to straddle competing, at times contradictory, political and intellectual perspectives would be lost in favor of a linear story of a talented leader who devoted his best years to an organization he later denounced. Malcolm's final quest to promote human rights was cut short by the very political violence he had so frequently brandished like a rhetorical sword. Malcolm's death ignited debates over his legacy that continue to this day. The New York Times characterized his life as a Greek tragedy, the tale of an extraordinary and twisted man consumed by his own violent fantasies. The National Paper of Record claimed world pays little attention to Malcolm's slaying in one story, while reporting Malcolm called a martyr abroad in another, signs of the conflicting interpretations that greeted his passing. Harlem countered this opinion, with many fondly remembering Brother Malcolm as a teacher of profound eloquence, a political leader of unimpeachable integrity, and a husband, father, and Black man whose personal sincerity helped define a new era in the world's collective racial imagination. Around the world, global expressions of grief recognized Malcolm as an international icon. Africa, where Malcolm had spent much of his final year traveling, memorialized him as a fallen son who, in Kwame Nkrumah's words, lived a life of dedication for human dignity around the world. From Dar es Salaam, the South African National Congress issued a statement condemning Malcolm's murder, which made the front pages of the Tanzanian Standard. China's People's Daily accused the U.S. government of orchestrating Malcolm's assassination. In Indonesia, the site of the Bandung Conference that Malcolm had considered a model for Black solidarity, hundreds of demonstrators carrying banners staged a protest outside the American ambassador's official residence. London-area Pan-Africanists marched while brandishing portraits of Patrice Lumumba, the martyred Congolese leader whom Malcolm revered. The Council of African Organizations traced Malcolm's murder back to a force larger than the NOI, American imperialism. In Accra, Malcolm's friends led a memorial service attended by many of the Black expatriates who had welcomed him to Ghana twice during the previous year. They characterized Malcolm's death as the beginning, rather than end, of a new chapter of the human rights struggle being waged by Blacks all over the world. Malcolm X's most significant Black political adversary in life offered glowing tributes in death. Martin Luther King Jr.'s public statements following Malcolm's assassination, including telegram condolences, advanced a critically sympathetic elegy for his political and intellectual counterpart. King called Malcolm a product of the hate and violence invested in the Negro's blighted existence in this nation. Through biographical details of Malcolm's familial tragedies and teenage juvenile delinquency, King sketched a portrait of a Black genius capable of overcoming personal obstacles only to be felled by political circumstances.
"It is a testament to Malcolm's personal depth and integrity that he could not become an underworld czar," wrote King, "but turned again and again to religion for meaning and destiny."
Malcolm's death represented King's first public acknowledgement of him as a man of deep religious faith. King openly wondered what he might have become.
"Malcolm was still turning and growing at the time of his brutal and meaningless assassination.
King offered details of Malcolm's recent trip to Selma, where he had yearned to work with civil rights groups but seemed incapable of turning the corner that would allow him to commit to nonviolence. Beneath Malcolm's words of fire were signs of a new interest in politics as a way of promoting black dignity and racial equality. King recognized the convergence between Malcolm's struggle for radical black dignity and his own quest for radical black citizenship. Malcolm's public and private efforts to engage in struggles for racial justice showcased a man of passion and zeal in search of a program through which he could channel his talents. King's penetrating analysis of Malcolm's life and political influence reveals an intimate aspect of a professional relationship that remained strained throughout their lives. King respected Malcolm, even as he winced at the rhetorical barbs hurled his way by the only political leader who equaled his oratorical excellence. Martin had studied Malcolm's speeches and interviews enough to cite The Hate That Hate Produced as the television documentary that introduced Malcolm to the world and to detail autobiographical stories with ease. Malcolm's personal sincerity and political integrity impressed King, whose admiring essay suggested that, under different circumstances, the two might have become friends. Yet King faltered in his description of Malcolm as a man in search of a program. Malcolm's improvisational final year outlined multiple strategies for black freedom, distilling the struggle for black dignity at the local, national, and global levels. Lacking the resources and time to transform civil rights struggles into a human rights movement, Malcolm left a legacy of revolutionary politics that, shortly after his death, would galvanize black power activists. But his greatest impact may have been on Martin Luther King Jr. Chapter 9. The Radical King. The winter of Malcolm X's death marked the beginning of Martin Luther King Jr.'s political radicalization. King had spent the previous decade expanding the boundaries of American democracy by turning once disruptive protests into part of the political mainstream. After Malcolm's death, King challenged the alliance between the government and the civil rights movement he had helped to broker by making new demands on President Johnson's legislative and political agenda. In the beginning of the year, King tested the patience of a supportive White House by pressing hard for voting rights. By summer, he went further by defining rising civil unrest as a product of institutional racism and poverty that required far more material and political resources than ever imagined by the architects of the Great Society. The struggle for voting rights found King back in Alabama, the state judged by the SCLC to offer the best and most potentially dramatic illustration of black disfranchisement. The SCLC and the SNCC both claimed Alabama as their territory. SNCC activists burrowed into Lowndes County, located in the buckle of Alabama's rural black belt, smack dab in the middle of Selma and Montgomery. Cities where King and the SCLC enjoyed considerable networks. Lowndes contained a particularly brutal history of racial terror, serving as one of the main conduits of the convict lease system that virtually re-enslaved tens of thousands of black folk after the Civil War. King and John Lewis, the leaders of the SCLC and SNCC, vowed to work toward an operational unity that had been continuously stymied by disagreements over strategies, tactics, and hurt feelings caused by the considerable attention King's presence garnered wherever he went. SNCC staff working in the rural counties of Alabama remained dedicated to the slow, grinding, and tedious work of building a movement by helping local people organize. They considered King's decision to march 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery to highlight the disfranchisement and police violence facing black voters as the kind of spectacle that Malcolm X had rejected with the March on Washington. Malcolm's presence in Alabama shortly before his death still lingered among some SNCC staff, especially in light of 26-year-old Jimmy Lee Jackson's death at the hands of Alabama state troopers during a melee in Selma following a nighttime demonstration in Marion, a town 27 miles northwest of the city. Over the first 2 months of the year, King led a number of demonstrations in Selma in between fundraising efforts, his church duties at Ebenezer, and bouts of ill health that doctors attributed to stress, tensions that were exacerbated by a constant barrage of credible death threats in Alabama and elsewhere. Against this backdrop, King approved, but did not participate in, the planned demonstration originating from Brown Chapel AME in Selma, where Malcolm X had spoken the month before, and destined for the state capital of Montgomery. 600 demonstrators, led by SCLC aide Hosea Williams and SNCC chairman John Lewis, marched from Brown AME through Broad Street, Selma's main thoroughfare, before turning left to ascend the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Alabama state troopers in blue uniforms spread across the four-lane Highway 80 to block the procession. They were joined by more than a dozen of Sheriff Jim Clark's possemen, riding on horseback and armed with cattle prods. As Lewis and Williams advanced toward the east side of the bridge, they were given 2 minutes to disperse over a bullhorn wielded by Major John Cloud, the commander of the state troopers. A minute later, all hell broke loose. A sea of white-helmeted state troopers swarmed the peaceful demonstrators, many of them outfitted in their Sunday church clothes, bashing anyone in their sights, women and men with batons. White spectators, watching the proceedings from businesses that lined the road, cheered as if viewing a sporting event. Mounted law enforcement officers charged at scattering black Americans, as if they were chasing runaway human chattel from another century. Then, tear gas turned the escalating chaos into a scene of unimaginable horror. Bloody Sunday galvanized voting rights efforts in Selma, turning King's latest mobilization campaign into an international news story. ABC News broadcast footage of the afternoon of violence on Highway 80 later that evening, preempting a screening of Judgment at Nuremberg, an award-winning film depicting the aftermath of racial genocide in Europe. On Tuesday, King led a group of 2,000 determined marchers whose hopes of traveling beyond the area of Sunday's violence were thwarted by fresh threats from law enforcement. King's decision to march just short of the hundreds of Alabama state troopers prevented a second violent confrontation, but came at great cost to his reputation. SNCC activists, while still not officially endorsing the march, felt that King should have pressed on no matter what the obstacle. The Tuesday turnaround incensed SNCC staff, who channeled Malcolm X's voice in criticizing King's behavior as a betrayal of local people committed to securing the vote. Expressions of outrage, grief, and support for the movement poured into Selma from all parts of the country, including the White House. Thousands of Americans descended upon the city, including white liberals upset over the images of racial violence against civil rights activists. The violence in Selma pushed Lyndon Johnson to accelerate his plans to send voting rights legislation to Congress. The death of James Reeb, a white minister from Boston who had traveled to Selma to support the movement, only to be murdered by racist vigilantes after the Tuesday demonstration, forced Johnson's hand, as did the sight of more than 1,000 protesters outside the White House. Reeb's death in Selma, like the killing of white activists Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman in Mississippi the previous summer, inspired national headlines, allowing the movement, once again, to leverage the human tragedy of white victims into a national moment of political reckoning. Johnson addressed the controversy at a press conference staged at the White House Rose Garden on Saturday, March 13th. "What happened in Selma was an American tragedy," he observed. Johnson said the violence represented a crucible through which the United States would better perfect the Union, strengthen democracy, and, in so doing, reveal the heart and the purpose and the meaning of America itself. He suggested that racism undermined the grandeur of the American experiment and violence sullied the moral aspirations of all its citizens. "It is wrong to do violence to peaceful citizens in the streets of their town," said the president. "It is wrong to deny Americans the right to vote. It is wrong to deny any person full equality because of the color of his skin." An early morning court appearance and the obligation to deliver James Reeb's 2 p.m. eulogy forced King to promise the president that he would be listening to your message on TV with great interest and appreciation. In perhaps the most powerful speech of his presidency, Johnson, during a March 15th special address to Congress, characterized the black citizens gathered in Selma as long-suffering men and women who peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. The president's vivid description recognized Selma as part of a long, unbroken chain of patriotism that stretched back to the founding fathers and historic battles waged in Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts, during the American Revolution. Johnson compared black demonstrators in Selma to the soldiers in the Battle of Appomattox, which signaled the end of the Civil War, making a claim for the civil rights struggle as the natural heir to Reconstruction's unfinished legacy. At stake for all Americans, the president observed, was nothing less than the destiny of democracy, a political system that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. had publicly debated over the previous decade. Racial discrimination, Johnson argued, lay bare the secret heart of America itself. He boiled the struggles for racial justice down to their root political and moral essence, reflected in the American creed: to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man. By confronting the crisis in Selma, Johnson suggested the nation would rediscover its moral purpose as liberty's surest guardian for all Americans. King listened intently as the president challenged the entire nation to understand that the treatment black citizens endured in Selma would never again be tolerated. Johnson announced plans to introduce comprehensive voting rights legislation that evening. "And we shall overcome," Johnson proclaimed, echoing the movement's unofficial anthem. "Black Americans," he said, "were the era's true heroes, exhibiting unwavering faith in democracy that produced historical breakthroughs." King wept at the flurry of words, which seemed the culmination of a decade spent in the trench warfare of racial struggle. SNCC Chairman John Lewis, who watched the speech alongside King, felt Johnson spoke as both a president and a poet. King called Johnson from Montgomery to offer words of praise and encouragement. The speech, according to King, would help lead the way toward the salvation of the Negro. Johnson thanked him. "You're the leader who was making it possible," Johnson said. "I'm just following along, trying to do what's right." After 5 days of marching that began in Selma, King resumed center stage in an unfolding national drama in Montgomery on March 25th, where 30,000 gathered to see his speech. The multiracial crowd made up the biggest civil rights demonstration ever produced on Southern soil. Its defiant participants included the militant students bold enough to invite Malcolm X to Alabama. Veterans of the Montgomery bus boycott took a symbolic bow in advance of King's speech. Rosa Parks' appearance elicited rapturous applause, her vivid recollection of how Jim Crow's indignities robbed her family of land at odds with her public image as a genteel agent of change who accidentally stumbled into becoming the first lady of the movement. And for the second time in less than 2 years, large swaths of the American public listened to King's televised speech. King described nonviolence as a weapon of peace, unsheathed from its scabbard, to wage struggle in a conflict between good and evil that spanned from Selma to the White House. He lauded President Johnson's voting rights speech as one of the most passionate pleas for human rights in American history. King argued that no wave of racism could stop the movement for racial justice gaining momentum across the nation. He challenged those gathered to create campaigns against segregated public schools, poverty, and hunger until blacks and whites lived together in decent, safe, and sanitary housing. Predicting a season of suffering ahead, King found inspiration in nonviolence's capacity to change whole communities on the road toward creating a peaceful nation, a society that can live with its conscience. He closed by rhetorically asking, "How long? How long, how long, how long would it take to achieve the dream of a beloved national community?"
Not long, he answered, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Montgomery found King at the pinnacle of his power as a national civil rights leader and international statesman. He addressed the nation as a virtual political co-equal of the president, a Nobel Prize recipient who marched under federal protection. 19 weeks and one day after his speech in Montgomery, a beaming King would accept a commemorative pen from Johnson, who had just signed the Voting Rights Act into legislation. But that spring, King was riding a rising crest of political emotion into new terrain. He wrote an essay, Behind the Selma March, published in the April 3rd issue of Saturday Review, outlining the radical vision that would come to grip his politics that year. We are happy to know that our struggle in Selma has gone far beyond the issue of the right to vote and has focused the attention of the nation on the vital issue of equality in human rights, he wrote. King's emphasis on reimagining black citizenship as a human rights struggle echoed Malcolm X's efforts to do the same over the previous year. Barely noticed at the time, the essay marked a shift in King's approach to achieving radical black citizenship. Human rights encompassed more than formal legal and legislative breakthroughs. It required both the elimination of racial prejudice and economic injustice and the guarantee of justice in every aspect of black life in America. It required, in fact, nothing less than a revolution. On May 20th, 1965, surrounded by Vice President Hubert Humphrey, Bayard Rustin, Atlanta Mayor Ivan Allen, and liberal Republican and mayoral candidate John Lindsay, King addressed the American Jewish Committee at the Americana Hotel in New York. Buoyed by Humphrey's private reassurance that the Voting Rights Bill would be passed during the summer, King spoke to the 1,500 in attendance about the larger meaning of the quest for black citizenship. Well, the stirring lesson of this age is that mass nonviolent direct action is not a particular device for Negro agitation, King informed the assembly. Rather, it is a historically validated method for defending freedom and democracy and for enlarging the value to benefit the whole society. Civil rights, according to King, look toward the universal through the particular experiences of black struggle. He reminded the audience to never forget that civil rights struggles had led to a broad war on poverty concept, which ultimately will benefit more whites than Negroes. King felt increasingly comfortable publicly defining the movement as one without limits, despite critics and supporters who viewed him as only qualified to discuss racial matters. Instead, King implored the audience to reimagine the nation's entire democratic project by recognizing that, when civil rights activists demonstrated around the nation, they represented the best example of citizenship that America had ever witnessed. Then, King crept gingerly into the topic of Vietnam, not yet the political maelstrom it would become, but sensitive enough for the SCLC to decline offering an official policy on the subject. We must work to end the war in Vietnam, King pleaded. He talked about the inadequacies in our poverty program, hinting at a fundamental contradiction in the Great Society's dual efforts of ending poverty and escalating the war. He cited war, racism, and poverty as three areas where there is a moral and spiritual progress. He quipped that, although it is nice to have an integrated lunch counter, he didn't want to find the milk served at the counter suffering from nuclear radiation. The speech laid out clear themes of race, war, and poverty that King now embraced as his political calling. On the subject of Vietnam, King followed on the heels of Malcolm X's revolutionary criticism of the war. While Malcolm had energetically denounced the United States for its involvement on the wrong side of a worldwide struggle against colonialism, neocolonialism, and imperialism, King took baby steps. His description of war as obsolete and his claim that the world must have nonviolence or non-existence stopped far short of Malcolm's identification of Vietnam as the struggle of the whole Third World.
Yet King's decision to publicly criticize the war and point out the flaws in the nation's anti-poverty efforts exemplified his political courage. Although Malcolm X had accused King of timidity and student activists had charged him with vanity, King possessed tremendous courage, a strong will, and significant political resolve. His willingness to defy a president he considered to be an ally reflected the passion of a social movement leader whose vision of black citizenship and racial justice encompassed far more than ending racial segregation or securing the right to vote. On August 5, 1965, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act in the same room where Abraham Lincoln, 104 years earlier, had signed the Confiscation Act, which helped pave the way for slavery's emancipation and freed enslaved black people serving in Confederate armies. Johnson signed a bill that contained no such half measures. Martin Luther King Jr., Roy Wilkins, James Farmer, and Rosa Parks were among the civil rights leaders that listened to Johnson discuss voting rights as a triumph for freedom as huge as any victory that has ever been won on any battlefield. But King would have less than a week to bask in the achievement. Just 5 days later, unrest erupted in Watts, a predominantly black neighborhood in Los Angeles made up of working, lower, and middle-class residents. Police brutality against local blacks suspected of criminal activity sparked the violence, a pattern that echoed the civil disturbances the previous year in Harlem, Brooklyn, and Rochester, New York. The uprising fulfilled Malcolm X's grim prediction that political rebellions would soon grip the nation. The Los Angeles riot exposed deep fissures within the civil rights movement, the limits of the Great Society, and the depths of racial injustice. The scale of the Watts Rebellion hardened civil rights opponents while radicalizing the advocates of Malcolm X's struggle for black dignity. Critics interpreted the waves of burning cars, burglarized stores, and chaos as criminal acts of lawlessness. Reports of sniper fire, widespread destruction of property, and violence were further heightened by the response of Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty and Police Chief William Parker, who encouraged anxious white homeowners to purchase guns while dismissing allegations of police brutality raised by civil rights leaders and local activists. The political and cultural fallout from Watts forced King to confront the depth of black anger against ongoing racial oppression that stubbornly withstood the combined power of landmark civil rights and anti-poverty legislation. Watts also marked the beginning of the end of King's close professional relationship with Lyndon Johnson. King arrived in Los Angeles 6 days after the violence began amid false rumors that blamed the Nation of Islam for the riots. A rising death toll had recently secured Johnson's undivided attention on the crisis. On his second day in the city, King spoke to hundreds of residents at the Westminster Community Center, a neighborhood association in the center of ashes that made up a once vibrant community. It was a searing, contentious, and uncomfortable conversation. King strode twin rhetorical paths, claiming belief in nonviolence and demanding reports of the effects of racial oppression palpating through Watts. Restless jeers of "burn" and plaintive calls for jobs and justice were drowned out by King's urgent baritone. He pleaded with the crowd to never forget white martyrs of the movement, as recent as Viola Liuzzo, a housewife and mother of five killed during the Selma demonstrations. He publicly embraced the black community's ideological diversity by claiming, "Elijah Muhammad is my brother, even though our methods differ." Privately, King confided to Bayard Rustin that he now understood that blacks required not simply the opportunity to eat hamburgers, but the financial means to buy them. King now sought a way to explicitly link the quest for black citizenship to the struggle for economic justice. He called for civilian review of the police, a suggestion angrily rejected by Chief Parker, who claimed, incredulously, that Los Angeles suffered from no racial discrimination. King's run-in with Parker and Mayor Yorty found him confronting old adversaries of Malcolm X, who had spent over a year traveling back and forth to Los Angeles in the aftermath of Ronald Stokes' killing. Following a fruitless 3-hour meeting, King deflected press inquiries searching for substantive breakthroughs, while Yorty dropped all pretense of diplomacy and accused King of promoting lawlessness by calling for civilian review and the resignation of Chief Parker. King and Lyndon Johnson spoke by phone on Friday, August 20th. Johnson bemoaned congressional cuts to a poverty war being fought circumspectly, rather than robustly, due to political calculations that King had neither the time nor the patience to seriously consider. Both men worried that political enemies would seize upon urban violence as an excuse to curtail the nation's fitful racial progress. Although Johnson conceded that the government was not doing enough to end poverty, the dealmaker in him preferred a compromise to a stalemate. Sounding history's drumbeat, Johnson described black impoverishment as losing ground every day, in desperate need of a massive political and financial commitment.
"That's right. You said it right there,"
replied King to the president's declaration of being ahead of the curve on racial justice. King told Johnson that Los Angeles required an immediate infusion of anti-poverty funds. "The country's got to stand up and support what I'm doing," said Johnson, asking King to reinforce his leadership on issues of racial and economic justice. "We've got to have some of these housing programs, and we've got to get rid of these ghettos, and we've got to get these children out from where the rats eat on them at night," Johnson said, getting himself worked up. He complained in detail about how the Senate's cuts to his poverty bill had stymied his efforts to get a handle on urban poverty and potential riots. The president implored King to mention the substance of Johnson's recent Howard University address, which discussed the need to assess racial equality by measurable outcomes and not just theoretical opportunities. Confronted by new depths of the very oppression he had eloquently described at Howard, Johnson claimed that black freedom, however important, represented a single part of a sprawling agenda. Vietnam's looming threat to the Great Society made both men wary of potential conflicts of interest between them.
"They all got the impression that you're against me on Vietnam," Johnson said.
King deflected by claiming that his peace advocacy stopped short of calling for a unilateral withdrawal. The conversation ended with the president teasing King that he could contact the White House at any time, even if he had to call collect. King laughed and replied,
"All right."
Months later, in Beyond the Los Angeles Riots, an essay published in the Saturday Review, King wrote that Watts exposed the imperfections in the civil rights movement and misguided white racial policy in American cities. He announced bold plans to confront the poverty in black urban communities that Malcolm X had spent his entire public life addressing, without mentioning Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty or New York Mayor Robert F. Wagner by name. King criticized big city politicians who lacked statesmanship and compassion on race matters, but nonetheless personally welcomed me to their cities and lavished King with praise until he pressed them about local race relations. Watts transformed King, who now surveyed the depth and breadth of racial segregation, poverty, and anti-black violence with new eyes. He characterized the past decade of civil rights activism as extracting uneven gains nationally. As the South freed itself from some of the worst vestiges of racial slavery and Jim Crow, the North lagged behind, plagued by institutional racism that ratcheted up black unemployment, residential and public school segregation, police brutality, and crime. He daringly interpreted violence in Watts as a form of social protest by residents of a region unfamiliar with nonviolence. Like Malcolm X, King now regarded violent disruptions rooted in anti-black racism as a form of political protest, one that he disagreed with, but refused to cast negative judgments against. This proved to be a major turning point in King's rhetorical strategy against white supremacy and institutional racism. The most important part of King's essay described nonviolence as an urgent, strategic tool of revolutionary social change, one that remained a powerful demand for reason and justice. The uprising in Watts represented one direction that the black freedom struggle might pursue if nonviolence failed. Black nationalists, King argued, were skeptical of defeating the tricks of sophisticated segregation and impatient enough with American hypocrisies to embrace violence, a description that drew from Malcolm's oeuvre without mentioning his name. King described massive, disciplined, and nonviolent demonstrations as a shield against both white racism and black anger, noting how the strategic presence of 100,000 blacks in big cities could disrupt the political status quo and prevent even the most reactionary politicians from violent retaliation. These were the bold maneuvers that Malcolm X had repeatedly called for in his Farce on Washington speeches, where he scorned the evolution of the March on Washington from a daring showcase of civil disobedience to a stage-managed demonstration where protesters marched between two dead presidents rather than confronting the living one. Less than 2 years later, and with very little fanfare, King publicly sided with Malcolm. King, now more forcefully than ever before, called for massive civil disobedience to be used as a political tool in service of a black revolution. Although he took care to assure readers that no people or property would be harmed during his proposed northern demonstrations, he described nonviolence as a peaceful sword that blacks needed to firmly wield in pursuit of justice. Watts gave King his clearest understanding to date that black citizenship required the raw power to not only change hearts and minds, but fundamentally alter power relations between blacks and whites. This meant utilizing black bodies to change the status quo of American race relations and make the beloved community a reality. King framed nonviolence as creative, moral, and powerful enough to smash the savagery of Southern segregation and, in the process, earn the respect and emulation of Northern activists. King's words eloquently frame the next chapter of his public career as a civil rights organizer. They also reveal Malcolm X's influence on his political worldview. It was in the aftermath of Malcolm's assassination and the Watts uprisings that King's transition began, from a Nobel Prize-winning political mobilizer whose eloquent composure from a Birmingham jail, speech at the nation's capital, and presence in Selma placed him in front of the ranks of American political royalty, and to a revolutionary dissident vilified in quarters that once feted him. Watts marked a decisive shift in King's thinking about racial and economic justice, one that found him in closer alliance with Malcolm X. In the late spring of 1966, King attended the White House's Civil Rights Conference, organized the last detail by the Johnson administration on June 1st and 2nd, where he enjoyed perhaps his last public rapprochement with Lyndon Johnson. Intended as a public victory lap in the wake of Johnson's soaring Howard University speech and the subsequent Voting Rights Bill, the conference, which occurred almost 1 year after that shining moment, had morphed into something far different since its initial planning. Riots, Vietnam, and white backlash hovered over the entire proceedings. During a Face the Nation television appearance 3 days before the conference, King edged closer to a complete break with the White House on the subject of war, racism, and democracy.
"I know where your heart is. There your money will go. And the heart of many people in the administration and others happens to be in Vietnam," observed King.
The strain between King and the president could be seen by the civil rights leader's relatively low profile throughout the conference. Johnson feared being upstaged at his own event, and he lavished praise and attention on hand-picked surrogates who doubled as political insiders: Solicitor General Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP's Roy Wilkins. Marshall, the crusading litigator behind the epic public school integration, viewed King's demonstrations as unnecessary diversions from the legal work crafted by himself in the NAACP, so his elevated position, alongside Wilkins, as a keynote speaker rankled King. Over 2,000 delegates representing civil rights, business, civic, religious, and political groups attended the two-day affair. The president warmly greeted Boston Celtics basketball star Bill Russell after the outspoken athlete's talk on racial bias and employment. Vice President Hubert Humphrey opened the event with a speech decrying racism and poverty.
"Slumism is segregated,
Inferior schooling for those who so urgently need the best, he said.
Humphrey received a standing ovation from delegates for exposing America's shame. Supporters of the president, such as the Urban League's Whitney Young, praised Johnson as determined to right the past wrongs, arguing that the White House conference points the way for all of us to follow. In contrast, SNCC and other dissident groups condemned the event as a public relations stunt. Delegates attended discussion groups centered around issues related to racial justice, equality, and citizenship, where they could offer recommendations, but the entire affair turned out to be a highly controlled exercise orchestrated by Lyndon Johnson. The president, finding himself fiscally constrained by a Congress already concerned with midterm elections, fearful of growing military commitment in Vietnam, and painfully aware of how King's recent rhetoric had highlighted disappointment in the Great Society, positioned himself as a statesman, capable of listening to reasonable dissenters and hovering above partisan politics. Johnson showed up unexpectedly to the Sheraton on Wednesday evening, greeting King, Roy Wilkins, and A. Philip Randolph in the hotel's banquet hall before promising to give my days and such talents as I have been given to the pursuit of justice and opportunity for those so long denied them. For King, in light of the president's increased attention to Vietnam and retreat from advancing his Great Society ambitions, his words fell flat. King managed to speak at one session but was largely overlooked by Johnson, the White House, and the press. The administration's efforts to diminish King's stature were a response to his deepening criticism of the Great Society and, implicitly for the most part, Johnson's leadership. On Thursday, King retreated to his hotel room. He only appeared at the evening dinner because organizers asked Coretta to perform the national anthem before the event's closing. King departed the conference disappointed in what he correctly interpreted as a permanent breach with Johnson on core issues of justice, citizenship, and dignity, a split that would soon play out in vicious debates over the future of the Great Society and American democracy. King, who abhorred personal confrontations with friends and adversaries, complained to staff that he felt disrespected. Following the conference, King went to Mississippi, where he resumed the role of fireman, a position he once vowed to never perform again. When James Meredith, the first black student to enroll at the University of Mississippi and a strong figure in the movement, was shot by a white vigilante on June 6th, King rushed to his bedside, despite Meredith's penchant for being a political wildcard. Meredith's one-man march against fear across the entire state of Mississippi had received little attention until he was met with violence. The shooting drew SNCC and Stokely Carmichael to Mississippi as well. Carmichael and SNCC's staff still felt residual tension from their disagreements with the SCLC and King in Selma. But Mississippi was SNCC territory, so familiar to Carmichael as to be considered a second home. No other organization could claim the extensive number of contacts or active projects in the state. Any successful march would, out of necessity, rely on SNCC's network. Carmichael instantly recognized this potential leverage and set out to take advantage of it. Carmichael and SNCC used their intimate knowledge of Mississippi to take over the spirit of Meredith's march. Over the next 3 weeks, King walked through Mississippi alongside Carmichael in a demonstration that came to be known as the March Against Fear. Media coverage provided Carmichael and SNCC a national platform that they used to redefine the black freedom struggle and articulate a vision of black political self-determination and power. King treated Carmichael like an equal. Although he felt uncomfortable with SNCC's increasing militancy, King made a concerted effort throughout the march to project a sense of political solidarity in front of reporters. He refused to distance himself from Carmichael or SNCC, whom he respected despite their political differences. On June 7th, Bobby Kennedy, King's one-time nemesis turned crusading liberal senator from New York, announced at the University of Natal in Durban, South Africa, that if racial apartheid did not end, there is going to be a major crisis not only in Africa, but throughout the world. That same day, King led a press conference with fellow movement leaders before continuing James Meredith's march across Mississippi. Flanked by Carmichael and Corps leader Floyd McKissick, King addressed the reporters and television cameras that had descended on Mississippi. King lauded SNCC's Herculean efforts in the state and talked of plans to complete the march that Meredith began.
"I am confident that this march will have as great or greater impact than the march from Selma to Montgomery," said King. "We are going all out to make this the largest march ever held in this section of the country."
He continued,
"We want to put President Johnson on the spot. He called a conference to fulfill these rights, and we want them fulfilled. But words can't stop bullets. We want action, and we want it now."
King's passionate words and challenge to the president pushed him away from civil rights moderates and closer to the political radicals who, following Malcolm X, offered harsh truths as a balm for the nation's searing racial wounds. After the press conference, King and movement leaders drove to Hernando, the spot where the wounded Meredith had dragged himself out of harm's way one day earlier, and began to march south on Highway 51. Mississippi state troopers warned demonstrators, including King, Carmichael, and SNCC activist Cleveland Sellers, to stay off the highway. "We walked on the main road from Selma to Montgomery," protested King. One trooper replied that they could walk to China but could not use the main road. After the back and forth, three troopers shoved King, Carmichael, and Sellers to the ground. King called after colleagues to restrain Carmichael, who attempted to pull away from the group to confront the officers. As Carmichael lunged, King held his arm and yelled,
"Get Stokely, somebody! Lay on him!"
The maneuver worked, and King privately chided Carmichael afterward, reminding him of the greater responsibility imposed on him by his new leadership role. The scene captured in miniature the way the rest of the march would unfold, with Carmichael issuing words of fire reminiscent of Malcolm X and King reining him in. Debates over tactics of nonviolence versus self-defense, strategies of political self-determination versus interracial coalitions, and ideologies of black nationalism versus racial integration became sensationalized in journalistic narratives that framed the march as a generational struggle between the mature King and the youthful Carmichael. Boiled down to its essence, the debate centered on whether black citizenship could be achieved through political reforms, or if more radical changes were required to fundamentally restructure American democracy. King, unbeknownst to most people, favored the latter course. Carmichael's plan to make the march a criticism of the Johnson administration alienated Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young, who decided against supporting the demonstration. King chose to stay rather than abandon the young SNCC militants. He hoped to utilize the creative tension within the movement to craft a radical agenda that, although nonviolent, might disrupt America's racial status quo. On Wednesday, June 8th, following the departure of Wilkins and Young, King read a march manifesto whose description of Mississippi as symbolizing every evil blacks historically faced recalled the stinging rebukes of Malcolm X. He issued a public indictment against anti-black racism in blunt language that matched the tenor of the times. King, Carmichael, and other organizers directed the march on a detour through the more rural parts of the Delta to register voters, mobilize the poor, and raise political consciousness. The sight of King attracted curiosity seekers, journalists, and locals. SNCC's nickname for King, the Lord, summed up the awe he inspired in Mississippi, where elderly women delivered food and water, and even young militants walked alongside him.
"I've heard so much about him," remarked a maid in the small town of Coldwater, "and I just wanted to see him."
King wore new boots, sunglasses, and a yellow hat with a straw band to march from Coldwater to Senatobia that Wednesday. Between 200 and 350 demonstrators walked single file down the highway in punishing 90-degree heat. To loud cheers, King told one group of young people to tell their parents to vote in order to put some of these mean sheriffs out of office and elect black candidates. Over the next 3 weeks, the march made its way from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi on Highway 51. King alternated between flying to Chicago, where he spent most of the year organizing a movement to end segregation in the largest city the SCLC ever tackled, and marching in Mississippi, where his presence represented a clear draw for organizers, local people, and reporters. Carmichael filled the vacuum in King's absence. He welcomed King as a galvanizing force in service of black political self-determination. Carmichael promoted the demonstration as an opportunity to organize the entire state of Mississippi, most importantly, the backwater towns and rural hamlets that had been the site of unspeakable violence against black locals and civil rights workers. If King provided the march with the credibility of a statesman, Carmichael lent the proceedings the urgency of a radical. He rankled journalists by characterizing Mississippi as full of a bunch of racists. As the march progressed, SNCC organizers stressed the need to recruit black demonstrators to ensure that Mississippi would not be a replay of Selma. Northern white liberals could not rescue the state, Carmichael argued. Only black people could do that. On Thursday, June 16, 1966, Carmichael transformed the political imagination of the civil rights movement and America's racial consciousness by calling for black power during an evening rally in Greenwood, Mississippi, with over 600 attendees. Earlier in the day, Carmichael had been arrested for trying to put up an overnight camp on the grounds of a black elementary school.
"This is the 27th time that I have been arrested," said Carmichael. "I ain't going to jail no more. What we gonna start saying now is black power," he cried. "What do we want?"
The crowd chanted back in the call and response tradition of the black church.
"Black power!"
The slogan reflected SNCC's evolution, born out of a unique blend of racial integration, radical democracy, black nationalism, Gandhian nonviolence, and a black Christian ethic of love. Black nationalist elements had always existed in SNCC, their power tempered by the push toward interracial democracy, the influence of King and activists such as James Lawson and Ella Baker, and the belief that the movement contained a spiritual basis that would compel political transformation. But 6 years of organizing against white supremacy in the Deep South, the frustratingly inconsistent support of Northern liberals, and a federal government more concerned with winning an international war than establishing domestic peace, had radicalized the organization. The small towns of Sunflower, Tunica, Belzona, Grenada, and Tallahatchie were unfamiliar to most Americans, yet SNCC and Carmichael argued these were the true laboratories of racial justice and American democracy. Black power identified racial integration as secondary to amassing political power capable of promoting radical black citizenship and dignity. It also vociferously criticized the violence, segregation, and economic injustice emanating from white institutions. In this sense, black power represented a structural critique of the multiple ways that racial terror and hypocrisy informed American democracy. The solution, black power activists implied, lay less in entering all white spaces than in building enough political, economic, and cultural power to decide whether or not to join the political mainstream, develop black institutions, or some combination of both. Black power also gave a name to the simmering tensions that plagued the White House Civil Rights Conference, internal divisions within the black freedom struggle, and the competitive interpretations of race, war, democracy, and citizenship that critically divided Martin Luther King Jr. and Lyndon Johnson. The phrase both described the movement Malcolm X had led since the 1950s and encompassed something more. As defined by the civil rights militants turned political revolutionaries, black power linked a structural critique of racism, white supremacy, and war to the struggle for black dignity and black citizenship. It allowed leaders, organizations, and individuals to more ably straddle the political thought and activism of Martin and Malcolm without choosing sides. Black nationalists, integrationists, liberals, conservatives, women, men, theologians, college students, prisoners, and the poor would all find kinship and organizing ballast in black power. King arrived in Mississippi the day after Carmichael's Black Power speech. He played down internal differences in favor of presenting a unified front. He defined the term Black Power as simply the ability to make the power structure say yes when it wants to say no. The definition worried the Los Angeles Times, which feared that Carmichael and King were speaking in almost one voice. King spoke to a crowd of 1,000 in Greenwood, Mississippi, that Friday, standing in front of the LaFleur County Courthouse. Black people continue to march, King explained, because we are tired of being beaten, tired of being murdered. Although King matched Carmichael's passion, he tried to steer energies away from any hint of violence. Andy Young, one of King's most pragmatically effective political aides, who also had known Malcolm X, stressed to reporters that the radicalism behind King's message positioned him and the SCLC in conversation with Carmichael. He portrayed Carmichael as simply filling Malcolm X's role as both a racial provocateur and visionary capable of furthering the movement by pushing black protest as far as he can, carrying along white liberals as far as they will go. Young argued that SNCC's position on black power isn't too far from ours except in style and semantics. The call for black power drew King closer to SNCC, and especially to Carmichael. Long days marching alongside one another led to late nights debating and laughing together. For the duration of the march, King became both a national leader and a field worker in the movement. Carmichael credited the time spent in Mississippi for turning the grudging respect many in SNCC felt toward King into open admiration. He marveled at King's courage in the face of threats, hecklers, and law enforcement along the demonstration route. King's star power awed him. Black Mississippians rushed to greet King as he walked on highways, into towns, and through plantations to recruit marchers and encourage voter registration. Local people risked economic and physical reprisal to come near him, a phenomenon that Carmichael witnessed up close after being accidentally knocked over by a group of women rushing to see the Lord. King decided not to openly criticize the feelings behind the call for black power, but he remained wary of the phrase's growing association with violence and anti-white sentiment. For the duration of the march, which grew into the biggest civil rights campaign since Selma, King assumed the uncomfortable position of trying to maintain the primacy of a civil rights movement under assault by the politics of racial fatigue, Vietnam, and anti-black violence. From Atlanta, King told reporters that the term black power too closely mirrored black nationalism, Malcolm X's political philosophy, the growing power of which King denied in the face of overwhelming evidence.
I see no significant trend in the country toward black nationalism, King explained, 4 days after Carmichael's cry sounded the biggest clarion call for political self-determination since Malcolm.
Carmichael's description of racial integration as a subterfuge for white supremacy elevated black political and economic power above romantic ideas of interracial brotherhood. But Carmichael was no conventional racial separatist. He cherished white colleagues, grieving over the death of Jonathan Daniels, a white volunteer martyred the previous year in Alabama, and maintaining SNCC's dwindling interracial staff even as he urged, like Malcolm X, that whites form organizing beachheads outside of racially segregated black communities. On June 18th, King, along with 300 demonstrators and dozens of reinforcements, marched down a Mississippi highway toward Belzoni. They were antagonized by a burning cross and cars teeming with racists carrying signs reading Ku Klux Klan, Knights of the Green Forest. Marchers also passed a large placard with a photo of a young King attending Highlander Folk School citizenship class in the late 1950s. Mississippi state officials had rebranded the program as a communist training school. Organizers urged black residents of the Delta's wide-open spaces and cotton fields to temporarily abandon their work and join them. Many did, ditching hoes used to till cotton and stepping out of humble shacks with slanted roofs to join the march, even for just a short time. King and Carmichael deepened their friendship during the Meredith March. King still abhorred confrontation, but he gently chided Carmichael in private for rhetoric that could be misinterpreted by the press and thus hurt the wider movement. King's ability to forge personal connections with everyone he encountered, young or old, black or white, educated or illiterate, impressed SNCC activists such as Cleveland Sellers, who found him easygoing with a delightful sense of humor. On June 21st, King led a detour to the small town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, for the second anniversary memorial of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner, whose 1964 deaths at the hands of a combination of racist law enforcement officials and local white terrorists less than 2 weeks before the passage of the Civil Rights Act made them enduring martyrs. Throughout the detour, marchers confronted as many as 300 white locals, including Deputy Cecil Price, the folk hero, Klansman, and law enforcement officer facing federal charges in the disappearance of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. King led the group down the red clay streets toward the Neshoba County Courthouse, the site of a public memorial.
"Oh, yes," said King, recognizing Price standing in front of the courthouse, surrounded by deputies. "You're the one who had Schwerner and the other fellows in jail?"
Price